it'll warm up again after a minute or two. Are we running?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, well, let's start in. Let's just begin with prayer as we start. Father God, we ask for your guidance today as we think of problems facing each one of us and facing your church. Help us, Lord, to see clearly, to understand rightly, in a way that will ground us deeply in your truth. Help us in this, for Jesus' sake we ask. Amen. Okay, well, we've tried to get this in these three talks in sort of a series of historical development. Joshua last night, starting from within the New Testament and dealing with the book of Revelation, giving us a tremendous picture of the God who is God of glory, of infinite power, but who makes himself known as a lamb who was slain, and the tremendous paradox of that, and how that led John, persecuted and pastor sent off to keep him out of trouble, writing to a beleaguered church, and yet with enormous visions of power of God over even the Roman establishment. And then what Marty has said this morning, it just strikes me of Jesus' teaching about the kingdom of God being like a mustard seed, which was extraordinarily small but would grow to something of great size. And that's what, in a way, she was talking about this morning, starting as a mustard seed, 120 people in one room. I'll be looking at the Sermon on the Mount this morning, which was even less probably than 120 people there at that point, or at least at the start of that sermon, and expanding into something really huge and powerful and important. As you've heard this morning, we have started off on this idea from this article in November in CT on the power of weakness, dealing with this wake-up call of that we're not quite as powerful as we thought we were in American culture. And we thought it would be just good to wrestle with this to see where we end up. Now, I'm not going to be... Our topic is fear not, but I'm not going to be dealing directly with the psychology of fear, which would be an enormous other topic to deal with, but rather more... what is the way that the paradigm God has given us to understand ourselves in this world, where we are a minority, where we are have all sorts of things going on around us which are which we did not plan, and which many of them are going against us. So what we responded to is as this in this article of Gerson and Wehner saying after interviewing. Evangelical authors, academics, college presidents, non-profit leaders, anyone they could get a hold of in Christian leadership. He said, they universally claimed that without exception, the leaders we consulted believed evangelicals are at a pivot point in their relationship to American culture. They described reactions among their fellow Christians ranging from angry combativeness to disillusioned withdrawal. Now, those are two extremes that, I mean, if this is what Christian leaders are, I want to say, wait a minute, let's see what's going on. Let's see what we can speak into this. So that's why we've organized this theme weekend as we have. Now, I want to talk about Jesus' images here of salt and light. He starts off, as you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and so on, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers, but ending with this weird, strange, paradoxical, doubled beatitude, somehow that it's blessed to be persecuted. And you think, wait a minute. And that's divided between persecuted for Christ's sake and for righteousness' sake. For example, Stephen died for Christ's sake, John the Baptist for righteousness' sake, which is a bit different. John the Baptist wasn't for Jesus, for his faith to Jesus, but for righteousness, for what was right and just. This strange paradox of being blessed in persecution. Jesus then turned after the Beatitudes, and the first thing he does is give us what I want you to think of as our Christian social identity. Our Christian social identity. This is, okay, here you are, an individual Christian who lives out the Beatitudes. Drop this Christian into the pond and see what kind of society, and see what kind of ripples come out from as this Christian gets dropped into a pond like a rock. So what will you be in society? Remember that they are a tiny minority. Minority within Israel. Even smaller minority if you put them within the Roman Empire. Other places they're described as aliens and exiles in the world. And to this little group he said, you are salt and light. That was their social identity. Salt of the earth and light of the world. Matthew 5:13-16 is the passage. I'll be picking up on, if some of you read the book I wrote called Chameleon Christianity, I'm picking up on that theme and taking it, I'm not developing it as much as is in the book, but I'm taking it on more into our present time. That passage goes, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. So again, the emphasis on, again, it's very much spinning off from Marty's talk this morning, our character, our life together, the nature of our expression will be salt and light, and it will then show people that God is the Lord, that Jesus is the Lord, and you must follow him. Give glory to your Father in heaven. See your good works. The positive meaning of those words, as Marty mentioned this morning, salt is valuable for taste and also for being a preservative. Light represents an ideal of goodness and truth, but also is valued for its ability to illuminate what is in the darkness. Not always a welcome illumination. I think Jesus understood. He didn't bother explaining this very much, but went right on to talk about the failure of being salt and light, which most of the passage is actually about the failure to be salt and light. He wanted them to live this out. Remember, it's to live this out in this world where they are a tiny minority. Nonetheless, people will see your works and give glory to your Father in heaven. He warned here of two ways to abort the mission. To miss the boat, to drop the ball. Two ways of malfunctioning salt and light seem to be his main concern. I want to suggest here that Jesus gives two different images of ways to not be conformed, or to be conformed to the world and not be transformed by God, as Paul would pick up in Romans 12 later on, that opposition. Two ways to be worldly in a way that he's calling us out of in the failure to be salt and light. First, they could be like salt, but which had lost its taste. This was evidently familiar to people around the Dead Sea. There was quite a lot of salt on the ground. There were salt mines that had been so contaminated by other chemicals that it looked just like salt, any other salt, but it had no taste, which means that none of the functions of salt would it do. And it wasn't salty anymore, so it was useless for everything that salt had been useful for. So what is Jesus warning against here? I want to grapple with each of these images here, the images of the failure to be salt and light. Well, it was a scary and dangerous world, especially if you're a dissonant minority within it. He was warning them of one major danger here, which is he's wanting them to resist the pressure to just blend in to that surrounding culture for the sake of safety and comfort, and to allow their distinctive beliefs and behaviors and ethics and patterns of living to be diluted, compromised, and so to be resonant with the culture, as opposed to dissonant. Think of tuning a guitar, and you want the strings to be resonant with each other, not dissonant if you don't have something in tune. And so there would be a powerful incentive, he warns, to adapt, to accommodate, to assimilate into the wider culture, and so there's less conflict with that culture. And you get along with everybody just fine, without dissonance, but without saltiness. And as many commentators have pointed out, salt is not sugar. So this is the people of God being, to be like a chameleon. Basically, we know the little salamander-like dude who can change colors depending on whatever he's walking on, adjusting their protective coloring to whatever color is the dominant color of their surroundings. This is like to live dressed in camouflage so that when no one notices any difference between you and your surroundings. Or think of sort of social camouflage. We can think of all sorts of examples of how this works among Christians, for the church, in the church and outside the church. Pattern of compromising within to what's going on around our culture. When you live in a culture as powerful, as imaginatively powerful as American culture is, huge areas of compromising are tempting. That we would throw away specific Christian teachings that are not resonant with the society around us, ethical teachings that are not resonant with the society around us. They are unpopular and offensive in the wider culture, such as what we believe about God, truth, power, sin, sex, money, celebrity, for example. So to run through some of the main idol systems in modern America. And if we're blending in and being the chameleon, we outgrow these things and leave them behind us because we're contemporary and we can blend in to what's around us and we leave them behind. I've given this example recently, so some of you would have heard it in a recent lecture, but I have to rely on Doonesbury to get this across in a more powerful way than I can. Because here, this guy's not a Christian. Gary Trudeau is not a Christian, but he gives this intriguing interview of a pastor with two people who are wanting to come and possibly join his church. So there's a man and his wife sitting across from him having a nice conversation about whether they want to join his church or not. So the pastor says, "What would you like to know about the little church of Walden, folks? Don't hold back. I know how difficult it can be to choose a church." And the man, "Well, what's your basic approach here, Reverend? Is it traditional gospel?" Pastor, "In a way, I like to describe it as 12-step Christianity. Basically, I believe that we're all recovering sinners. My ministry is about overcoming denial. It's about recommitment, about redemption. It's all in the brochure there." The wife, "Wait a minute. Sinners? Redemption? Doesn't that all imply guilt?" Pastor, "Well, yes, I do rely on the occasional disincentive to keep the flock from going astray. Guilt's part of that." Husband, "I don't know. There's so much negativity in the world as it is." Wife, "That's right. We're looking for a church that's supportive, a place where we can feel good about ourselves. I'm not sure the guilt thing works for us." Husband, "On the other hand, you do offer racquetball." Wife, "So do the Unitarians, honey. Let's shop around some more." You see, what's he doing? This guy's writing this. He's not a Christian, but what's he doing? I'll leave you with that for a minute. It's followed by some more cartoons, one with the pastor talking to a friend of his who asked him, "Well, what happens to God in your church?" And the pastor answers, "Well, we don't talk so much about God anymore. He comes with a lot of baggage. The whole male Eurocentric guilt thing." You see, and then, well, what are... So Well, I'll give you one more. Satirical. Not, this is not Doonesbury this time. This is Garrison Keillor at his most satirical. He pretends to report. This is a piece out of a longer article, which calls it's called The Current Crisis in Remorse, which is brilliant. But this, he's not pretending he's a journalist. This is him, well, writing a satire. In 1976, a major Protestant denomination narrowly defeated an attempt to destigmatize the prayer of confession by removing from it all guilt or guilt-oriented references. Lord, as we approach thy throne of grace, having committed acts which we do heartily acknowledge, must be very difficult for thee to understand. Nevertheless, we beseech thee to postpone judgment and to give thy faithful servants the benefit of the doubt until such time as we are able to answer all thy questions fully and clear up all thy doubts. Well, so what he's basically saying is, God, wait a minute, I'll get my lawyer and let you speak to him. But you see, what is this? This is mockery of saltless salt. He's a Garrison Keillor, maybe some sort of Christian, I don't know, but not a, certainly a strong evangelical. We're being mocked by the loss of our own birthright. No one's taken it from us. This is not something nasty secular humanists have done unto us. This is something we've done to ourselves. And we're being mocked by the secular culture for throwing it away. So this is one kind of worldliness, selling our birthright, because we're getting our security from within the world, because we've achieved a lack of conflict with the world. So we fit right in. So that's much greater security. But then there's the equal and opposite kind of failure, which is Jesus' other warning. It warns us against being like light put under a bushel basket. What does this mean? Well, this is light. It's light, all right. Kind of, there's enough light in here to light up the whole house, but it's put under a box so that it's darkness. It's trapped. There's no light at all. This is the opposite kind of response to the pain of being in a minority situation. It's to hold on. These are people who don't compromise an inch. They look at the saltless salt people. They read the Doonesbury cartoon and they say, "Not me." So they don't compromise an inch at all, but they retreat into a tribal Christian subculture behind a fortress wall and form a quarantined Christian ghetto. Within these walls, they begin to speak a tribal Christian dialect, to read tribal Christian books only, to listen to only tribal Christian music, and feel very right, good, spiritual, and safe. Now, the first one I called the chameleon syndrome. This one I call the muskox syndrome. If you know anything about the wonderful Arctic animals called muskoxen, whenever they're under threat, they form a circle with very formidable horns facing out, and the young or a sick or whatever are within that circle. Now, to be a better illustration of what I want, they would not be facing out but facing in and delivering the odd kick out backward to a world outside that they don't really look at much but they feel threatened by. So the tribal model is that of a muskox responding to its predators. A tribal Christian group will always need more rules than the New Testament allows us or gives us in order to create solidarity in the tribe in an ever-changing and threatening world. So it's usually a place for legalism to flourish. Rules multiply for the sake of safety. For example, there are Christian schools which teach literature because they believe in literature, but forbid reading of Shakespeare or Dickens, because neither of these guys were born-again Christians. We want an environment to be safe for our children. The chameleon and muskox syndromes are two opposite ways of responding to the threat of being a minority group, the threat of persecution, the threat of feeling very uncomfortable in a larger group. The saltless salt chameleons protect themselves by blending in so that there's no conflict between them and the world. The muskoxen with they're like light under a box, protecting themselves by tribalizing out of the world so there's no contact with the world. One, there's no conflict with the world. The other, there's no contact with the world. To be salt and light, where Jesus wants us, is like sitting, and I want you to think of this image also, it's like sitting on the ridgepole of a roof. If any of you have seen the film The Fiddler on the Roof, which I think starts with the idea of a guy with fiddling on the ridgepole of sitting up at the top of a very steep roof with very steep pitches, looking very insecure. He's going at it with his gorgeous Israeli folk song with his fiddle. And what I want to get through here is that there's two slippery slopes. There's two slippery slopes. Actually, I want to say on almost any important moral or ethical issue, there's always two slippery slopes. There's never one slippery slope that we have to worry about. There's always slippery slopes going in both directions. One becoming ever more compromised and blending in, one becoming ever more tribal, both with in self-protection. Opposite pitches on the ethical roof from the ridgepole. Accommodation one way, tribalism the other. And it's always dynamic. The roof is slippery, so you're moving. You don't just have an anchor halfway up or halfway down on that roof. You're moving. The roofs are slippery. Jesus gives these warnings to not lose our saltiness and our light. I was intrigued. It occurred to me last night, listening to Joshua's lecture on the Revelation, in the letters to the seven churches in Revelation, part of the approval and warning and admonition to those churches is their failure to be salt and light. Is in terms of, not all of it, but their failure. So Jesus is keeping an eye on the church. You know, he told us to be salt and light. That's in the early 30s of his active minute, beginning of his ministry. Here, let's say the book of Revelation was written in the 90s. This is 60 years later. Jesus is still watching the church. And are you paying attention to what I told you there? Jesus is still watching the church. All this much later. Because he cares. Are we still being salt and light? And if you think of that, the church of Thyatira, you tolerate the woman Jezebel. And he rebukes them for tolerating her, for having no church discipline that's functional, to having someone in the church who's creating chaos in the church with horrendous ideas, horrendous behavior, but somehow is not disciplined by the church. He rebukes Laodicea, also being lukewarm and deluded, both of them saltless salt. On the other hand, he looks at the church of Ephesus, and he says, you have been strong to deal with false teaching. In other words, you've stood. You were not saltless salt. You stood against the against wrong teaching. But now you've lost your first love, and this light is hidden of the great love that ought to be there under in the church. Maybe that is hidden under a great layer of orthodoxy. Likely. Jesus observes and corrects this these years later. Let me give you a couple of wider examples. I want you to get a grip on the dynamic here of, in a way, on the psychology of minority, or what it can be anyway. I want to tell you a Jewish joke, which gets the point across quite nicely, because this is a problem in every religious tradition as it confronts modernity or change. But particularly secularism and modernity. Every religious tradition has to deal with this problem somehow, some way. There were two rabbis. Almost every Jewish joke starts with that. There were two rabbis. The Orthodox rabbi and then a Reform rabbi. And the Orthodox rabbi says, there's a boy in my congregation who says he wants a Harley for his bar mitzvah. What's a Harley? The Reform rabbi replied, oh, well, a Harley is a motorcycle, but what's a bar mitzvah? And you see, this is exactly what I'm talking about this morning. You have these rabbis each falling off opposite sides of the roof. One disconnected from modern culture, the other disconnected from his own tradition. A good rabbi ought to know both about Harleys and bar mitzvahs. connected to the modern world and to the roots of his own faith. Just as Jesus echoed the salt and light teaching in saying we need to be in the world but not of the world later on in his ministry. Another example, not a religious example, but a good one to get a hold of. Over 100 years ago or so, large numbers of people immigrated to the Boston area from Ireland, Italy, China, and also to other countries. they were minorities here and were treated as minorities, which means they were treated pretty badly by Bostonians. Now things are different. If you want to be in politics in Boston, it's a real good idea to have either an Irish or Italian name. In other words, they've blended in very well. Some people would say they're running the place. At the same time, there was then, and still is now, Chinatown. Chinese immigrants decided they didn't really want to blend in and wanted to maintain their own culture, family structure, education, language, and so on, and weren't tempted to blend in. And again, Chinatown's still right there. You can see it in Boston now. Visit it. Now, for racial and ethnic groups, there are very good reasons for doing both of these things. Taking both of these options. Blending in and maintaining separation. Some of the painful parts of being a minority in a larger society are mitigated by either of these two patterns. That's why they're so powerful. That's why the forces are so powerful that push us in one direction or another, either direction. But, and this is my point, Jesus says, you are my church, and I don't allow you to do either of these things. You can't do this. Okay for a racial group to do, but not if you come under my name, not if you're going to be my church. You can't do this. So you must defy these enormous sociological forces and resist them. And again, he's saying this to this tiny minority, probably less than 120 people, who were in this massive Roman Empire. Defy these pressures on us, which could push us in either direction. And he never said it was going to be easy. A strange thing that I've noticed is that many people respond most by reaction and get into these two positions by walking backwards into them. By that I mean you can be indignant at the moral spinelessness of the chameleon Christians around and shocked by how they're compromised by the relativism that surrounds us and so on, but then start walking backwards right into the circle of muskoxen because you're with people who also are horrified by the relativism and compromise of the spineless chameleons. You can also be horrified and freaked out by the rigidity, legalism, and lack of love of the muskox community and walk backwards to get away from that into something that's profoundly compromising and assimilating into the group of chamelea, whatever they are. In this way, by looking critically at the other, mainly, you can walk backwards to a place which you really have not chosen. You haven't chosen either, but you've walked backwards into it. And if I, for example, find many people fed up with both, but with no sense of a clear path for where to head, where to go, how to. We have a lot of people coming through here who are very relieved to find out that Jesus was against Christian tribalism. It's a shock and a wondrous realization that to discover that Jesus was against Christian tribalism, which he was, and we better believe it. Now, moving on here, there's two options. This is again referencing back this article in Christianity Today, who are describing the shock on Christian leadership of no longer having such clout as we thought we did. But they point to two different options, the Wilberforce option and the Benedict option. And some of you may be familiar with that choice because it's gotten a fair amount of publicity and interest and discussion since then. But these are two ways of describing the two responses to it. First of all, the Wilberforce option. This is what they in this article argue for and say we should track on this. This is using Wilberforce as William Wilberforce, the British parliamentarian who became a Christian after being elected to Parliament and was a tireless defender of human dignity and rights in the late 18th and early 19th century England, and is known particularly for his work on the slave trade, working against the slave trade, and making it illegal, and then ultimately just about at the time of his death, and slavery itself became illegal. He was known for his battling for many causes for the common good, not just Christian causes or causes that would fight, that would benefit the church. And these guys are just putting him out as an example of, this is one way we can go, which is to don't get discouraged and quit and hang up, give up, but keep on trying to infiltrate, trying to be a transforming agent into society, as Wilberforce was, because he's a wonderful example anyone can point to as to what Christian action into society can bring. And his efforts, anybody can see, has made a great difference, which is have held all the way down, continue to make a great difference today, as have Christians who've done the same sort of thing, had a great difference down to today. They argue, don't retreat from discouragement, but keep on in efforts to bring transformation into the public world, not just the private world, but the public world. And they give quite a bit of advice as to how to do this and how not to do it, which is quite sensible. For example, they take the efforts of the Christian right in past years, recent years, to apply first electoral force. Evangelicals behind being an elective bloc behind certain Christian people who would be elected to the legislature, passing that, getting them elected, and getting them into public office, so we can pass laws that will transform society in a Christian direction and make people better. And they point out that this has been a substantial failure. And was misconceived from the start. But that doesn't mean that we quit the idea of trying to transform society or see social change come. But to learn from a mistake is not to give up. To learn from the mistake is to be wiser and then go forward. They cite many ways in which significant issues of moral concern for the Christian have improved in the last 20 or 30 years. Fewer abortions, fewer divorces, lower percentage of teens having sex, lower homicide rates, and so forth. A number of different issues which have gotten better. Christian efforts have been effective in raising the visibility of sex trafficking globally, very effective in funding for AIDS treatment, say, in South Africa, effective in certain efforts at criminal justice reform, increasing fostering and adopting children. These are areas where there's really change, which we can connect to the efforts of Christian people. Not necessarily the church directly, but people inspired by the church, supported by the church, encouraged by the church, maybe in part funded by the church. Christian people and organizations have been involved in important ways in all of these. And I would add something Marty just touched on, something that they don't, is a huge role of Christians worldwide involved in reconciliations of potential conflicts in the last years. If you look at 1989 and when the Marxism collapsed in Eastern Europe, it's a huge role of Christian people, particularly in Romania and East Germany, the two ones I'm aware of, having a huge role to prevent a bloodbath happening as a result of that. The Romanian guy Marty referred to has had incredible stories to tell of calling for having a midnight or having night prayers, and the whole a larger square lit up, and they had PA system, and they would lead in prayer for love, for a new way of having government, and not persecuting, not basically coming in and killing the secret police, but rather forgiving them and going forward and building from there. Huge in Germany. Out of Leipzig, I think there were the military had 30,000 body bags waiting for turning the machine guns on the mobs. The soldiers wouldn't obey. The soldiers disobeyed. But the pastors, again, leading prayer for reconciliation and so on. The head, I can't remember the guy's name, was on the run, and he was offered a place to stay by one of the main pastors in the church, who had been totally his enemy, and wasn't killed, was protected from the mobs. So South Africa, the end of apartheid, huge role of Christians there in making that not a bloodbath. In our own country, where do you think we'd be without Martin Luther King? Where would we be on race relations without him marching under Christ and preaching the power of Christ here? We have no clue where we'd be on race relations in this country, but we wouldn't be in a good place. But here's someone under Christ's name. And this is where, you know, you think of Christian, you know, as he was saying this morning, Christian, oh, it poisons everything. Well, you know, that's someone like Christian Hitchens who wrote that Christianity, religion poisons everything. He has to say of Martin Luther King, his Christian faith meant very little to him. It was just veneer on the surface. What he did had very little to do with the Christian faith. What absolute rubbish! But he can't accept that his Christian faith motivated this hugely redemptive act, which we are all, each one of us, we gain from that every day. Every day we profit from what he did and the change in race relations. Even though we're not out of the woods, certainly on race issues, but my goodness, a great contribution was happened. They go on here. I'm talking about the article in CT here about how we have to be shrewd in our battles, which is all very wise. They suggest that in future years, this is an interesting thought, the public perception of evangelical Christians will be to some degree determined by how we treat the casualties of the sexual revolution, whether we treat them with judgment or with healing. There's going to be lots of casualties of the sexual revolution. We can be sure of that. We've seen enough already, but there's going to be lots more. What do we do? What is our contribution? Do we stand up and say, naughty, I told you so? Or do we actually do something to help? There'll be no shortage of occasions, and this is something to be interesting to talk about before. There's not going to be any shortage of occasions when we will have opportunity to defend human dignity and rights. And particularly as I forget who raised it this morning, but that what do we do now that unlike the early church, we have a Christian tradition that we've inherited, and we believe in being merciful and so on. What are the key places where we can make a difference? Well, for one thing, the Christian base is being spent and getting smaller and smaller that exists under our culture. The secularism, the materialism of our culture is going to be more and more of a part of it. There's going to be lots of places and times when we will see human dignity under threat. There's lots of occasions, but we need to be sensitive to it and sensitive to what God may be telling us to move for, a place for legitimate human actions here. So this is the Wilberforce option, is to get out there, roll up your sleeves, and to... Don't be discouraged to get in there and to make a difference. Then there's the Benedict option. This is named after Saint Benedict, Benedict of Nursia, lived 480 to 547 A.D. Started a number of monasteries, each one creating something of an oasis of Christian life, understanding, and thought. In the midst of the corruption and barbarity of the Roman Empire at his time, he's known for his rule of Saint Benedict, which was his guide in how to run such a community. The term the Benedict option was coined and pushed by a contemporary journalist called Rod Dreher, D-R-E-H-E-R, who's very much a Christian. He in turn got the idea from the last paragraph in a book by Alistair MacIntyre called After Virtue, a very well-known book published in the early 80s, After Virtue, where he tracks the dismal verdict on what has come of virtue today and has a very, very shaky hope for it. He gets to the end, and it comes from just actually Saint Benedict of the last two words of the last paragraph of his book. And I'm going to read you the last bit of the last paragraph of his book to give you a sense of where this term comes from anyway. And it's an important, it's an interesting thing to hear where he's gotten to, reading this whole, writing this whole book on the state of virtue in the modern world. Because he's a very accomplished philosopher. He says a crucial turning point in the early, that earlier history dealing with Roman history and the disintegration of the Roman Empire. A crucial turning point in that earlier history occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium. That means the Roman Empire. Trying to shore up the Roman Empire and ceased to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that empire. What they set themselves to achieve instead, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. In other words, see what he's saying, the turning point was when they gave up trying to patch up the Roman Empire and said, no, if we're going to maintain civilization, we've got to have other sources of that by forming our own smaller communities. We can't hope to shore up, prop up the Roman Empire. In my account of our moral condition, if my account of our moral condition is correct, we ought also to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached that turning point. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community in within which civility and intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. If the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are not waiting for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict. End of book. I'm Waiting for Godot is, as some of you know, is a play by Samuel Beckett, where he mocks the waiting for God idea. But this is where this image comes from, which is a very powerful one. Someone who's really grappled with what Western culture is doing and what he sees as a source of hope. His suggestion, of course, has huge implications for Christian people. He is, I think, some sort of a Christian, maybe. Lapsed, doubly lapsed Catholic. So I'm not how it quite works, but his, Benedict hasn't been a figure in the book before that. It's just Clunk, the last two words of Saint Benedict, something like Saint Benedict. He and Rodrera, who is picking up, he's back to the modern journalist, picking up the term or picking up that paragraph and picking up the term the Benedict option. His suggesting is putting hope in local Christian communities who understand the state of the world and which can hold to a truth which enables virtue to flourish despite the darkness and barbarity in society outside. Both see the Benedictine monasteries as some sort of a loose model for what is our hope. Now Rodrera has picked up that reference and written on the Benedict option as an alternative to Christians investing great hope in their ability to transform America or Europe or wherever toward greater civility and Christian life. What he means by the Benedict option doesn't actually completely disagree with Gerson and Wehner in the Wilberforce option. They're not two completely different options, but they overlap, and so his view is basically that he wants to be more radically Christian than the Wilberforce option, because he thinks if we follow the Wilberforce option, just trying to work to try and transform society, we will be swept away ourselves by the power of the secular culture around us. The secular advance, we'll lose our Christian identity, we'll lose our saltiness and our light and our children. And he says, there's no use pretending we can have significant political influence, for example. So pack in the attempt to influence the political world. back off political ambitions. We need to find new ways to build communities where we can bind ourselves to Scripture, to our own theology, to each other. Not just for survival, but to be salt and light for Christ in this darkness. In his own words, Christians need to, quote, build resilient communities within our condition of internal exile. Now, I look at these two options, and I think they're very interesting and helpful. I found this article in CT very helpful. But I don't really want to choose between them. And I don't want to be pushed to choose between them. Let me first talk about the liabilities of either one standing alone. I find that I want to encourage, I have and I want to continue, students who come through here who are interested in politics, I want to say, yes, go for it. Get a law degree, get whatever you need, and go for it, but be wise. Be wise and really think carefully. We've been discussing at great length recently a woman who's a law student now and very concerned for what to do with herself as a Christian and in this field. But having possible, not necessarily elective ambitions, but to be for a political engagement. But the danger of this Wilberforce kind of involvement is that we will not be careful enough to avoid the chameleon pattern, the chameleon syndrome, blending in, being salt with salt, living and working together, especially working together with shoulder to shoulder with strong secular and pluralist members of our society, with agendas that are set by a lot of other people. It's easy to see a lot of things their way, not the way we learned back in church or whatever. That can be good, but that can also be bad. Framed crudely politically, if we're inclined toward the left, we may pick up an overconfidence in the ability of government power and control to solve all problems. We may be overwhelmed by the brilliance of certain social or economic engineers who promise they know the way for social change, economic change to happen. And if we just tweak things this way and that way, then everything, of course, or education, too, that's another huge area of people who can transform it and to be completely different and wonderful in their theories. So there may be a loss for the chameleon in the midst of the, who's drawn toward the left or involving themselves toward the left, losing a sense of the importance of individual responsibility and the fall, the brokenness of human beings. We hear talk like a mantra about every human being is a glorious ruin. You need to be involved. You need to really have a grip on both the glory and the ruin. Political chaos if you don't have a grip on both. We could go into that afterwards. If we're inclined toward the right, the danger is to blend into the individualism, which really has no room in biblical thinking. For example, to resist any government regulation for anything. To pay no attention to the prophets or Jesus' teaching on care for the poor as a priority. Or, I would say, for care for God's creation and environmental stewardship. Radically absent from the standard right-wing agenda. So there's dangers on the left and the right. There's no safety in joining either side of this huge battle today. So the danger here in being in the Wilberforce option is blending in to whatever it is we're working with and to be transformed by them rather than transform them. And that's the Dreher and the Benedict option folks are right that's more of a danger than many people realize. That's more of a serious problem than is usually acknowledged. What is the liability of the Benedict option? Well, here obviously the danger is that the Benedict community can become a tribal community. It can be a community of muskoxen with their lights under a box, focused more on their own safety than on serving God in a radical way. These communities can be so overwhelmed by the evil in the culture outside and its barbarity that safety for them becomes isolation. Wonderful opportunities to interact and cooperate in all sorts of things in the non-Christian world are either not noticed or not permitted. The danger of community, which becomes tribal, is also that it multiplies rules and becomes legalistic. This happens sometimes. It's very hard to see the gospel underneath all the rules. Now, okay, what about engagement in our culture? Those are the liabilities. Now I want to shift to what positively we ought to be able to do. I use engagement because although I've been using transform also just now, but the word, many Christians don't want to use the term trying to transform the culture because they think that is utterly arrogant and that we can march in and change everything when that's real change is what God is going to do, not the result of our machinations. And so I want to respect that, but I find it hard to get too terrified by just the use of the word transform. I do want to avoid that arrogance, but I also want to keep the basic idea. I'm going to just give a few pressure points, totally inadequate in the sense of any sort of holistic picture. So a really holistic picture of what Christians could do to engage our culture would be a massive study and would be into all sorts of things that I'm not going to be able to touch, especially unless I keep talking till tomorrow morning or something like that. But even then, I'm not equipped. Many would say now that at least some of the emphasis of the Christian right was a mistake in its agenda of trying to get people just elected and holding public office to then pass legislation, and that legislation itself would be transformative and change the nation. Because laws don't, as many people would say, laws don't really change people that much. As they say, good laws do not make good people. Actually, laws that represent the ideal may not be good laws for real people. Because for a law to be a good law, it has to be obeyable, and most of the people at least need to want to obey it. Otherwise, it'll just be defied and swept under the carpet. Or break down the legal system even. So an enormous process of persuasion needs to happen before a law, which stands for something we want, will be a good law. Those people need to be persuaded that obeying that law is actually a good thing. And that is a massively greater job than just getting some people elected and having them cram through legislation. It'd be lovely if passing certain legislation would fix America. Right. People need to be persuaded. People need to be changed. Much harder, much longer job that I think in today's immediate culture, many Christians don't want to think of it as having to take that long or being that serious a project. Moral framework of the Christian faith must become attractive to our neighbors. And that's a huge task. The whole moral framework must become attractive, something they look to and they want it for themselves. This is not, for example, just what has happened, just giving an example of the reverse happening, traditional marriage in the last 50 years has not maintained even the attractiveness and authority of traditional marriage that traditional marriage has had. Because of the way marriages have been lived out, that we can see all around us, and the high divorce rate, even within heterosexual marriage, has lost its attractiveness and its authority in the general culture. This is why same-sex marriage went through so fast. People, including the gay community, were amazed at how fast this got. It's now through the Supreme Court. It's all signed and sealed, and there it is. Incredibly fast. People who started the whole discussion, Andrew Sullivan, this gay journalist, is just amazed at how fast it went. He sort of threw some seeds out, and there it is. And now it's in our lap. Again, remember Marty's talk this morning about Christians' way of life being attractive. This is a huge thing. Strategies of engagement. This is also totally inadequate. But just to throw out thoughts here that are just seeds for a discussion or whatever to think about. We mustn't be preoccupied only with political issues which are our own issues, bearing on the rights and freedoms of Christians, like religious freedom, which we need to fight for, but we mustn't only fight for religious freedom for ourselves. We need to deal with religious freedom for sure, but not only religious freedom. There are many ways, many areas where human dignity is under attack, which also need our thinking, attention, work, and activism. Social issues, economic issues, educational issues, racial issues. Wilberforce was an extraordinary, wonderful example here. While the whole slavery issue is what he's known for, he was also involved in social movements in Africa, along with missionary movements in Africa, in India, and engaging Parliament in social and economic problems in Africa and India, having a whole huge case against the British East India Company, the major mercantile, corporation responsible for so much of the British Empire. But also economic issues at home, cruelty to children, cruelty to women, cruelty to animals, against gambling, against the lottery. He was involved in almost 100 organizations, some of which he began himself, that were on issues that he felt were, it shouldn't be going on in this country where we have the ability to change it. We can change the rules here. And on many of these things, his impact has been really powerful and still with us. The thing that's come up a few times is Schaefer's term that I think is very useful. It's a distinction between being a co-belligerent and an ally. He said, we expect to be involved in the political process. We've got to be able to be co-belligerents with people who we are not allies on. And an ally is someone who would stand with you, would agree with you as to why you fought for this issue and all the other issues that you back as well. A co-belligerent can be someone who just stands with you on this issue, never mind why he or she believes in this issue or not, and never mind whether he or she agrees with all sorts of other things that you disagree with. On this issue, we can stand together, we can work together, we can get something done. This is the process of democracy, which amazingly, unlike the Roman Empire, we can have a hand in it, but we can have a hand in it that's effective only if we're willing to work with people who aren't just like us, who disagree with us on all sorts of things, but can agree with us on a certain point. That is the point in question. So co-belligerents, but not allies. It's as if I think sometimes Christians think that the political system must run like the church, and we have church discipline. We don't have people in church have completely different doctrines from us. Well, that's right. It shouldn't. But that's not democracy. This is a pluralistic country with people with all sorts of wild and woolly ideas, and we've got to work together with them, stand together with them, who are completely different. We've got this point that Gerson and Wehner point out, if we're going to be involved in the political process at all, we're going to have to work together with all sorts of gay people, with all sorts of strange ideas that are maybe weird and wonderful to them, but idiocy and horrendous to us. We've got to be able to do it. We've got to just go ahead and see them as images of God, who need God, who God loves, and who need the gospel as much as anybody. Here again, I think we're really this has to do with how it was working for the ideal as well, which is, I think, so dangerous. I talked to someone in the pro-life movement some years ago who said that during the Reagan administration, there actually was a real possibility of getting a constitutional amendment to keep abortion, to radically limit abortion. It fell because the pro-life group was divided, and some wanted, we will not accept, we haven't even pushed for an amendment unless it bans absolutely every abortion, even for rape, incest, etc. So it's a matter of principle, it's got to be every abortion. And then the rest of them saying no. And because the group came divided, couldn't agree on that, nothing happened. So everybody came home with empty hands. And here with a huge Christian population, there's nothing to show for all this effort, at least then there wasn't. There's a lot going on now. But compared to England with a minute Christian population, they've at least radically limited the time of an abortion. Because they were much more shrewd in terms of how they tried to exert political influence. Now that may be worked out time and again if we push if we demand perfection, we get nothing. And if we demand a perfect group of people to work with, the chances are we will get nothing. So in our rhetoric, also, we need to use a minimum amount of religious language if we want to be persuasive. And by not just language, but reasoning. We mustn't just quote Bible verses unless we're living in a part of the country where we can get away with doing that. That's fine. But even then, we want to reason in a way that is open to anybody, because we want everybody on board in this pluralistic democracy. If we want to pass a law, we need everybody on board with it, to pass it and to obey it. So connected to this is that Christians can be catastrophically predictable in the way they speak, present the gospel. We must try and break with this and be unpredictable somehow, to be fresh in the way we frame things, to try and use categories, terminology, and so on that makes sense to other people, rather than just crank out our tribal Christian dialect as we try and persuade people of anything. Again, C.S. Lewis is a great example of that, of doing that well. Last section here is community, or next to the last section. Hugely important. The vital importance of the Benedict option, I think, is in this idea of the need for community. Especially in a time of stress, persecution, struggle. It's not a time for Christian lone rangers to not only not get anything done, but to survive. Unless we stand together, we will likely not stand at all. It's a human need which ought to have special force for the church, the body of Christ. The purpose of Christian community needs to be to strengthen us in our own faith, awareness of our own history, our theology, our ethics, all at a deep level, and how to live it out. And we must be able to do it together. The thing of community isn't just you can go to a school and learn some things and come home, but it's to wrestle through issues and see them lived out as we spend time together with each other. We need more than just converts, we need disciples. The Great Commission is calling for disciples, those who do everything that Jesus taught. That's something to be much more than a convert. It doesn't say go to the nations and make converts of the nation, nations in the nations. It says make disciples. And he says everything that Jesus taught, the whole bag, everything. And that needs to be in depth, and that needs to be somehow lived out together. That's something we are so grateful for. We are to be able to work in Libri where the community is part of that. Where you see someone the next morning, you can talk about having said something they misunderstood the night before, wash dishes together, split wood together, carry stuff around, and share life together. And I think a communication of God's truth is possible in this way, that rather than sitting in church Sunday morning, shaking hands with the pastor on the way out, and that's it. And somehow we've got to do more. The church has got to be the center grounding of community, but I'm not calling for just the church. All sorts of other intentional communities can happen of every which kind of shape, description, size, which can help here. And this is what I think the Benedict option really has something to say, because I think that they're saying that the way it is now, we're not making it. We're not doing it. We're not making disciples. The depth of the Christian faith is not getting into our bones. And it's just not happening. And a Christian community does not need to be a tribal community. The danger of any community is that it would become so, but there's nothing that mandates it becoming tribal, meaning inward-looking, concerned only for its own safety. A community can be a huge generator of outward-looking. That's what we try hard to do in the Libri, to look out, get people to see out, and study what's going on out there in the world. get out there ourselves as much as we can, which isn't much, but we try. The community can provide a huge incentive to reach out. A concern for Christian apologetics is important too. How in the world do we function with the ideas that are flying around our heads in the world out there? How do we deal with them in a way without getting either just digging a hole in the ground and disappearing? I gave this something on the salt and light once to a college faculty, and one guy disagreed with my muskox illustration, And he said, really, a better illustration is a prairie dog who barks once and goes to ground. And so I often add that. I don't sacrifice the muskox, but I add that to an alternate method of just shouting once and then just going into hiding. And unless we're going to do that, we need to know, to have thought. How do we respond to relativism? How do we respond to the challenge that we're intolerant? Or how do we, you know... We need to help each other and to grow in this. Otherwise, we go to ground, or else we are belligerent. We just spit it back in their face, and we're bombastic, and we're judgmental, and that's the other way to go, which is not a way to go. It's ironic here that when we talk about community, that the opposition that these guys have set up is between Wilberforce and Benedict, because Wilberforce was passionately and totally Benedictine in his behavior. And he was totally grounded in the community, much more than any of us are likely to be. I mean, and nobody who writes on Wilberforce can do that without saying a huge role was his community. It's called the Clapham Group, but the Clapham Sect. It was ridiculed as the Clapham Sect. That's Clapham's a part of South London. They were all this group fairly wealthy. They bought houses near each other. They all went to a church together. They met together for worship, discussion, argument, planning twice a week. They existed, remember I said, from 1790 to 1830. This place was a hotbed of Christian discussion. They were dedicated to competent scholarship. A lot of them did research for each other to know how to research, how to understand what we're trying to do and how to do it better. But it never could have happened. They worshiped together. They prayed together. About 15 families, some single people as well, men and women, researching, organizing, confronting, how to put pressure on Parliament. Some of them were members of Parliament to change the whole British system. They were well connected to different members of society. Some said that they know everybody between them. They know everybody. In other words, they were connected to people in power. They made a point of this, and they used their money and their connections to. They saw this as a gift of God. They used this for the work of God to great profit. I think you could just think of the Inklings, with Lewis and Tolkien, and so on. Again, a few people getting together. That's much less. What they had was much less dramatic than the Clapham sect, because they didn't all live next door. They happened to be in Oxford. They commuted from London and so on. But they did a lot as a result that they never would have been able to do had they been separate individuals. Mm-hmm. By being together, they shared, they critiqued each other, and kept it going for a number of years and did an amazing amount. I just wish, again, you're getting my spin-offs from working in Labrie for 40 years. I wish we were all in Labrie closer to each other, because we could have helped each other in our thinking and our lecturing and all our doing much more if we've been closer to each other. We have an annual members meeting where we're together for about 5 or 6 days. But I think it'd be something much more would have come from it if we'd been together more. But we're not. We're in different places, and that's the way God has warned us. But I've just hungered for a greater collegiality, because I think there's a huge benefit in that collegiality. You see a great strength in group together because of all these different things. We must be able to pass a deep faith along to our children as something that's to them attractive and a viable hope for their future. That's something, again, the Clapham Group were all families and spent time as together as families. Thought that was very important. I get alarmed, frankly, by the work of this sociologist Christian Smith, now teaches at Notre Dame, who's interviewed. We've done wide surveys of American teenagers who go to church, Christian teenagers, and he articulates the summary of the average faith commitment of the church-going I'm not sure if this is just the evangelical church, but church-going American teenager is moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic therapeutic deism. That means I've got to be good. God is a nice guy. He wants me to be happy. That's about it. And morality and just God is here to make me happy. He wants me to be happy. That's the main thing to deal with. That is catastrophic if that's where if that's what the church is turning out for the next generation. That makes me think, yes, let's get back to this Benedict. Not to deny the need to work, because I want to, don't want to choose, but let's really not forget what the Benedict doctrine is saying. We need something much stronger at the base to survive and go on into the next generations as a result. So, God is our security here. To enormous pressures on us, which Jesus warns us about, which he's nailed long before modern sociologists have nailed the same these two same pressures. You must keep us from losing our true social identity. I prescribe both as worldliness, getting our confidence from the world, from either a world that we blend into because we've given way and we're just like everybody else, or a world we've tribalized out of, and then but we're in a close enough group of friends and so on, people just like us who laugh at our jokes and sing the same hymns, and that makes us feel secure because we're together with them. We must do better, but doing better, it must mean greater trust in God, and will not be easy, because it's ease that's pushed us into both of these options. It's self-protection that's pushed us into both of these options. It's having more comfort that's pushed us into both of these options. If we feel beleaguered, we must recheck the baseline for what God expects of us. I love Luther's work. It was not Luther's idea, but he talked about the left hand of God, and God having a left hand and a right hand. This isn't in the Bible. The term left hand of God isn't in the Bible, but the idea is. But he talks about the right hand of God being God doing extraordinary, radical, dramatic things like parting the Red Sea is the right hand of God. The left hand of God is just as strong as the right hand of God. But it's doing actions through human weakness, defeat, smallness, failure, and sin. God can be as active through all these things as he is through some triumphant, highly visible, miraculous event. The cross itself was surely the most important event ever of God's left hand. Here is someone who's destroyed and who's crushed by the powers of the Roman Empire and the nation of Israel. And yet, Sunday morning happened. I love the little line that Pilate, I guess it was Pilate, gave to the soldiers when they were away. They wanted to put a guard on the tomb and they wanted to make sure it was protected. Make the tomb as safe as you can. And I think, that's great. That's wonderful. The whole power of the Roman government, keep that tomb safe so nobody can get out of it. Well, Easter Sunday is a different ballgame. And the power of Rome was totally insufficient to keep the rock sealing the tomb. But the left hand of God, and God does so much of his work through the left hand. And we must get used to that. As one commentator mentioned, I think it's right with it, Robert Capon, the winner, he wrote a book on the parables of the kingdom. And this is the kingdom, you know, the kingdom, which is power. The parables, Jesus' parables of the kingdom, the winners in the parables of the kingdom are the little, the least, the lame, and the lost. What sort of kingdom is this? And if you're here last night with Joshua's talk, this is exactly what we would expect. A God who's reigns, who's the Lord of heaven and earth. How does he make himself known? A lamb who is slain. What? What are we dealing with? That's the same thing. This is who God is. This is the God who works in this way. And so this is a great danger of, I think, being caught up in American culture, because we're success, victory, splash, crash, bang, and we want it. It's all, yeah, and I can be a celebrity or whatever, some sort of stardom. It's so immediate. It's so superficial. It's so trivial. But this is not what our faith is about. We get sucked into this. I get sucked into this. We all can get sucked into this and yearn for the wrong things. Yearn for things that will only frustrate us and prevent us from really living out lives that are faithful to Christ. The winners are the little, the least, the lame, and the lost. This is how our God works. And so, as I often say, he called us, what he's called us to is not necessarily to win, but to be faithful each day. And then a key part of this is saying that I live by from Reinhold Niebuhr. I don't love everything Reinhold Niebuhr wrote, but he wrote a lot of wonderful things. He says, nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in my lifetime. Now that's, get a grip on that, because there's a lot in that. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime, rather. God is in this for the long haul. We are impatient for results, and maybe even wanting to put a brass plaque on our achievements before we pass on. God is the Lord of history, and as we trust him, he will enable each of us to be fruitful, as in to bear fruit, which will have eternal significance. This is a promise. People often ask, what promises does God give which apply to everybody, to every Christian? It's quite a hard question, really, to say. This is one, that you, if you trust in Christ, you will bear fruit, whatever the shape of your life looks like. He will see to it that you will bear fruit. But we've got to live in such a way that we will bear more fruit, a lot of fruit, good fruit. So Jesus taught us to be salt of the earth and light of the world, in order that it might be that, well, as he says, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Okay, I'll stop there, and I'll just throw it open. I've stirred up all sorts of hornet's nests. So go ahead.
I'm gonna write on your phrase.
Okay.
We're gonna just take a quick break.
Okay.
Let people stretch their legs. There's coffee tea. There's chocolate chip cookies. They don't have that out there. So grab some minutes ready for the bathroom. And come 15 minutes or so. Come back in.